Broadcasting and Dogs and Coffee. We're live.
We're live. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I am your persevering host, Mike Lafferty. Here with me today is frequent host. Walt Rebilliard. How you doing, Walt?
I'm caffeinated and awake for the minute anyway.
That is a good way to be. Joining us as well are frequent contributors, Christopher McLaughlin. How you doing, Chris?
I am thoroughly exhausted, but as always, thoroughly excited to be a part of the podcast.
All right. Is that exhaustion stemming from the life of a public educator?
It's coming from every social event in a year happening in the month of October. I was out Friday for both MST live shows in DC, and then Saturday was our one of our local Alamo's annual Halloween quadruple feature. So I was at Alamo from like 5 to 1 in the morning, and then I remembered I have like a job and stuff, and plus I'm coming down to the bitter, exhausted end of my latest and probably last freelance gig for Greater Than Games.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, cool. And joining us for the first time is Mr. Tim Kirk. How you doing, Tim?
I'm doing all right, other than having to wrestle my dogs off while we do this podcast. That's about the only difficulties I'm having today.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Tim is running a Kickstarter for a new superhero RPG. Well, it's actually a second edition of an existing superhero RPG, Hearts and Souls, and we'll be talking about that later in the podcast. First up, though, it's Review-O-Rama. We're talking about stuff we've seen and if we like it or not, and witty criticisms thereof, starting with Christopher McLaughlin talking about Bad Times at the El Royale. Chris, can you set the movie for us and tell us your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to give another shout out to Alamo Drafthouse, and no, I swear I'm not on their payroll, because we being a member of their rewards club, I actually got to see the movie three days before everybody else did for free, and we also got to see a live Q&A with the writer-director Drew Goddard afterwards, so it was really, it would have been very, very, very hard under those circumstances not to have a great night out. I mean, really just a super, super night at the movies. And it's a film that it's one of those rare modern films that I fell in love with right from the trailer, because I thought the mise-en-scene was just perfect. I mean, just the art direction and the set design and the way it was shot, it just really completely captured the mood of this formerly decadent 60s pleasure palace that is completely and utterly gone to seed in the most compelling way possible. And while I have sort of a love-hate relationship with neo-noir, you just have to kind of respect that somebody's doing a neo-noir in 2018 when you know most every other movie production studio in Hollywood is sitting around going, can we do another Highlander? We did one of those in a while. We get a guy with a sword or something. You know,
Christopher, why are you besmirching the legendary Highlander franchise?
I'm just saying that there are several Highlanders that we need to do an Old Yeller on, and Highlander, I think, would be one of these at this point.
There should have been only one.
My wife was a huge fan of the TV series for a while, and I can see why, and I at least respected how over 7 seasons they tried to make sense out of all that nonsense. But I don't know that it would be any great loss to Western civilization. You know, if I'm building the space arc, I'm probably going to put the Twilight Zone and Black Mirror DVDs in there before I put any season of Highlander in the vault.
Somewhere, Adrian Paul and Christopher Lambert shed one single manly tear.
Well, now you're going to pull me off track here, because I actually respect Adrian Paul as a human being for his appearance at Origin several years ago. But I'll tell that story later if you want. I don't want to get too far away from the movie.
Okay.
But the cast is just perfect. Everybody is completely committed to their various roles, and that's probably the strength of the movie, because It really is a lot more style over substance. The stylistic touches are great, like I said, but there are a lot of them that don't really seem to go anywhere. And I guess the overall effect on it was it's trying to use a hotel and strange people in it as a metaphor for something larger, in the way of, say, a Barton Fink. But the way it's shot with a disjointed overlapping narrative, it's almost like if somebody took the script of Barton Fink and handed it to Quentin Tarantino. So it's a very, very, very odd mix-up, a mixture of styles and influences. And it doesn't always work, but it works well enough to where I really, really, really appreciated it. It's really long. I mean, this thing is like Harry Potter sequel long, but it never really dragged. And even if everything didn't pay off, I thought it was a good enough. I thought it was well worth. Okay, I saw it for free. I can't say I got my money. Okay, if I had paid for it, I would have still gotten my money's worth out of it.
Okay.
And I guess through it all, the message still kind of came through. It's a film. It's very much a film about illusion and artifice. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is whether or not you're good or evil. Because without really spoiling the end is something you'd expect to see out of like a 50s Bible epic. You know, it's that much hand of God smiting the unrighteous. Like, that's kind of the Pulp Fiction side of it. You know, one of the great hidden things about Pulp Fiction is it's a moral tale. It's a good and evil story, and that aspect of it really comes through in El Royale. So, you know, I mean, I hate to pull people away from, you know, the 57th Halloween movie or, you know, whatever else is opening up this weekend. But really, El Royale is worth a couple of hours if you want to see something that you haven't really seen before.
It's kind of interesting work from Drew Goddard. I mean, his career, you mentioned the word quirky. I mean, his career is kind of quirky defined. I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Lost, Cloverfield, Cabin in the Woods. He did the screenplay for The Martian. He's writing the X-Force movie, which will feature, and they're not calling it Deadpool 3, but, you know. So, okay. But,
and the really amazing thing about Drew Goddard that I learned from the post-film Q&A, basically, if you were to, like, capture Chris Pramus, like, you know, take him down with a trank gun or something, and, like, deny him caffeine for, like, a week or so, you would have Drew Goddard.
Really?
Yes. He's like an uncaffeinated Chris Pramus.
Huh. Okay.
If you took Pramus and slowed him down from 45 RPM to 33 and a third, you'd have Drew Goddard.
Well, you know, Pramus has to be a lot faster because he's in the high octane world of RPG publishing, where Drew Goddard is only in Hollywood, so he can be a little more mellow.
Yes. And has been through it and hasn't lost his house or his mind. And really, I am pleased. Don't anybody think that I'm being mean to Chris Pramus. Chris Pramus has been awesome to me, and I kid him because I'm blessed to have had him as a longtime friend. And you don't meet too many authentic geniuses in this world, but the times that I got to hang around the Green Runine booth and hear Pramus and Rob Schwalb and Steve Kenson bounce ideas off each other, that was kind of like my, you know, that was like the best gaming education I had, and I didn't have to pay a dime for it. Just sit there and listen and marvel.
Thank you.
But yeah, but Goddard and Pramus, totally just different, same guy with different amounts of caffeination.
Okay. Cool. All right. So that is one vote for checking out Bad Times at the El Royale. And that's one I had in my to see list anyway, so that sounds like fun. Jacob, you switching gears completely. you recently reviewed a couple Starfinder books. Are you? Were going to review them. You read them.
I am going to review them. This is my first actual review of these things. I recently picked up the PDFs for the new Armory and the newest Adventure Path, which is the Against the Aeon Throne for Starfinder. The first of the new adventure path is called The Reach of the Empire, and it's the Empire in this case is the evil Aslanti Empire, which people in the Pathfinder universe will know as an ancient evil empire of magic users who, you know, long ago disappeared, but apparently they went into space. Is what happened, and
like all this time, witnesses,
indeed, and in all this time, they've been, you know, creating this vast space empire, and now that the rest of the population is making its way into space travel, they're starting to encounter the Aslanti again, and it's got some interesting things in here. The the premise of the adventure is the Aslanti have discovered the existence of a new type of star drive called the Rune Drive that'll allow them near instantaneous space travel. So a means to expand their empire and annex worlds without warning. So, and it's the hero's job to stop that. So beyond that, I won't say much more on the adventure. That way the spoilers can be maintained. Otherwise, it looks like a pretty fun adventure. It seems to maintain the same pace and star science fantasy action that the first adventure path really managed to maintain.
Okay.
As for the armory, I was pretty surprised with a lot of the stuff in there. Not as much surprised with other things. As with anything, there are a ton of new weapons and armor. Just like half the equipment section is weapons and armor. Additional weapon and armor accessories as well. There's a lot of weapons and armor art in this book, but the other art pieces, I would have liked to have seen a few more art pieces of, you know, more of the biotech and personal items. But otherwise, the art is still pretty good.
So you would call it satisfactory gun porn?
It is very satisfactory gun porn, absolutely. There are tons and tons of pages of weapons and all sorts of different designs and stuff that looks terrestrial, stuff that looks very alien. You would get a lot of good ideas out of this, even if you're not playing Starfinder. If you have just a generic science fiction game, it is well worth picking up the armory just for the ideas that can be generated in it.
Really? Okay, cool. That's high praise. I'm still fixated on the phrase satisfactory gun porn, which I think is going to be the new name of this podcast.
It's interesting to note that up until very recently, although I wasn't using the Starfinder system, I was using the Starfinder setting for a game, and I had a lot of fun with the setting. So that sounds like that would be a useful book for me to pick up at some point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's going to be one of those books that I can see everyone who is actually playing Starfinder having with them at the table. It's the Starfinder core rule book and the armory, much like people who are playing Pathfinder would have the Pathfinder core rule book and the ultimate equipment guide. It's pretty much a necessary like that. Because, you know, you get armor upgrades, weapon upgrades and accessories, biotech, magic tech, necrographts. That was something they teased when they were originally talking about all the personal augmentation you could do to yourself was necrographs, but they never really went into it in any of the previous books. In this book, they're really getting into it. Things like, you know, the necrocortex, which you implant into your brain, and you can transfer your consciousness to other undead and control them.
Just like the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Have you had an encounter recently?
my brother-in-law is an escaped Jehovah's Witness.
I see.
I'm trying to talk about religion with him because I don't have any particular dog in the, you know, dog in that race. But once he gets on the subject of that, he's like, "I'm gonna tell you what it's like to grow up in a cult." I'm like, "Really? It was that bad?" So it's, yeah, you know, it's kind of in the back of my mind. But he celebrates his birthday and everything now, so I guess he's recovered. So. Mm-hmm. All right, so that is two strong votes for Starfinder Armory, and I'm sorry, I've had chronic brain trauma. What is the name of the adventure path you reviewed?
The adventure path was the Against the Aeon Throne adventure path.
Against the Aeon Throne. All right, cool. So check those out. We will mention this on the Pathfinder forum so they can find our review.
And I have one little micro review I want to get to before we go into someone else. I recently picked up the new issue of Rainbow Bright. This is issue 1. It came out just the other week. And it is pretty much a good all ages comic, whether you're a fan of the original Rainbow Bright series or you want to introduce a young child into comics. I would highly recommend it. It has good story, decent art, and is a fun read.
So who's the writer and artist on this, if we're going to talk about it?
Let me see here. We've got the writer is Jeremy Whitley, and the artist is Brittany Williams.
Cool. Could you show us the cover? Okay. And that is by Dynamite. All right.
Yep. But I understand DC is going to be releasing their own version, and it opens with us finding out about the place where Rainbow Brights go, where they're sad, and it opens with like 20 of them being brutally murdered.
Are you sure you're not from the DC universe?
Sorry, that was funny.
Chris has some problems with DC. They've hurt him badly over the years.
Apparently. Yes. I was at the emergency room over the weekend, and Dan Didio swore he'd never do it again. But, you know.
Yeah, based on the new trailers, they're getting brighter. At least the movies are.
Well, they had nowhere to go but up from Zack Snyder, right? I mean, is Zack Snyder aware that, you know.
We can't do this. We can't do this, Chris.
I'm sorry.
We've talked about Zack Snyder so many times.
Yes. But I'm afraid somewhere we'll put a film camera in his hand again. And it's never again. You know, we need to teach our children in school about the horrible, horrible time that Zack Snyder controlled the DC universe and why we must never allow that to occur again.
Please go to Christopher's Facebook page. I'll be setting up a Never Forget Zack Snyder Memorial there in Manassas, Virginia, to keep this from ever happening again.
Yeah, it has a guy crawling out of his wheelchair to spray paint "False God" on it.
And now we're going to segue away from Zack Snyder talk. And I say, Walt, you had some stuff you wanted to review, right?
I don't know if I can follow that. Recently, when my wife and I have gotten 5 minutes to ourselves, where we weren't being accosted by Jehovah's Witnesses or dogs or dog-bearing Jehovah's Witnesses, we were watching The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. Really, really, really good series. One of the things that you don't often get is sorry about that. Dog's angry at the people at the door. One of the things you don't often get in a lot of straight-to-video horror movies is good characterization. Many times somebody is like, yeah, blah, 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 plot, and murder, go. And you really don't get that in this new series. You get very deep characterization of all the main characters. Supporting characters get a little bit of time too. But it really helps in the in what you feel for those characters as they're being basically molested by this house. I mean, this house has not only traumatized them into their adult years, it's done serious damage to their ability to relate to normal people who are not affected by this supernatural occurrence that happened to them when they were children. It's not an overly long series. You can, if you had a Saturday where, you know, rained or whatever, you could sit down and watch the whole thing. We've been watching it in chunks, almost completely done, but we just finished one of the episodes toward the end where a big reveal happened, and it was just, you know, you were left at the episode with your mouth hanging down because you couldn't believe, you know, the horror that this person went through. And it's more psychological than it is visual. There's not a lot of blood and gore, but I mean, they touch on a lot of things, family dysfunction, drug addiction, narcissism, basically the average American. There's a lot of good things to the series, and I highly recommend it. If you got a shot, check it out. It's really good.
Yeah, I just watched the first two episodes actually yesterday, and I was really impressed. I guess we should mention that this is a remake of a film that Chris has probably seen from 1963 that has been remade, oh, geez, several times before now.
And the book, I believe, was written in 1959, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I'm fascinated about, not having had a chance to see it yet, is the film version, the classic 63 version, is just such a taut, perfect little film for what it is. I was just trying to imagine how you could stretch that out over a series length, even if it is one that you're pretty much supposed to binge watch because it's streaming.
They did a really good job, not in just the horror aspects, but once again, in how these people are relating to their lives after being traumatized as children. There's an episode where one of the main characters, it's the youngest brother, is and there's really no spoiler to this because if you've watched the trailer, it's in the trailer. He's a drug addict because he couldn't really deal with reality after what he witnessed. He becomes a heroin addict, and the series jumps back and forth across time, so you get like a scene, and then later on they'll back things up so that you can see what led up to that. And in one of the episodes, the whole episode is about him trying to help somebody while he's battling his addiction, and you just get that pit in that knot in the pit of your stomach, like, is he going to use? You know, is this going to be the thing that pushes him back? And you're wondering the whole episode when he's going to slide, or if he's going to slide, or if he does it, how is he going to do it? And I think they played the episode really well. So, I mean, there's a good interplay between like actual trauma that they're trying to avoid in the real world as they're trying to avoid this trauma in the supernatural world. It's really well done. I was very surprised.
Yeah. I watched the first two episodes. It was, you know, it reminded me a lot of, like the first season of Daredevil on Marvel, just because they're on Netflix. It just, even some of the direction in the beginning credits kind of remind me of that. But yeah, and nice division, but nice split between the horror and developing the backstories of the characters. So yeah, I'm enjoying it too.
Right on.
So I guess this is the point where we pivot to talking just about RPGs. And before we talk about Tim's game, there's this little small publisher, a little plucky indie I just wanted to mention, Pinnacle. They're doing well for themselves, and they've got a Kickstarter out right now you might have heard of for Savage World Adventure Edition. They're struggling, but they just hit 144 grand after, like, I want to say 8 hours open. So if you're into the Savage Worlds or the worlds that are savage, you might check it out, because it's going to be a big deal this next year, I think.
And if such things matter to you, you could not be donating to a better human being than Shane Hensley.
He is a nice guy. He once saved a baby from drowning, I heard.
Well, he kept me from melting into an introverted pile of goo when I first asked him if I could write for him. So, you know, that's pretty close, right?
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. That's actually a really good, warm human story, and I feel bad for making a joke about him now. But
no, it's quite all right. It just felt like I took him an hour to get the question out, and he was so patient. I think he knew what was coming, and he had a yes waiting at the other end. So, really, I can never repay that.
All right. Cool. Well, hey, Tim, it is your spotlight moment. We would like to talk about Hearts and Souls Second Edition, which is your indie super RPG Kickstarter running right now.
Yeah, it is running right now, and it will continue until, I think, the 9th of November. I think that's when that cutoff date, because I ran it for 30 days, which is a full month. Pardon the dogs. They unfortunately can't seem to disinvolve themselves whenever I have headphones on. However, it is the second edition, and basically what I've done is I've taken the first edition and beefed it up. Beefed up its explanations, added a few more tools, and those tools are all aimed at what the game's core is about, which is what motivates someone. Even if you've been imbued with superhuman powers, why do you go out and put on a costume and save people and fight crime and do good? And that's pretty much the heart of the game, is what matters to the mechanics the most is why you're doing it. Not just how you're doing it, you know, with what powers, with what abilities for. It's why are you doing this? And that is the mechanic which drives the game and lets you, instead of having like fate point or karma like some other games, Hearts and Souls is dedicated to making your character's motivation and their personality drive the fundamental mechanic of the game. It allows you to do things like monologue in order to get a success against a more challenging target, or to re-roll the dice if you failed at something you think is important enough to monologue for. Like you're rescuing a child from a burning building, and that's important. Instead of having mechanics that restrain you at that point, you can monologue and push a little harder and get success. Banter works very similarly, but banter requires another person usually to interact with, unless your character talks to themselves in their head. But normally it's you need somebody else to play off of, whether that's a villain or another hero. You know, you're bantering, and that gives you a chance to get another chance at success in a situation that is pressuring your character. And the game is fairly mechanically simple. It's basically that dice mechanic empowered by drive and motivation. But there is also a counter to that, which is called stress. People familiar with certain games have probably seen stress used before. But in this game, stress is earned when you choose to take it. And when you take it, that often means you can't think of a monologue or a banter. So you go, okay, I'll take stress and get that reroll anyway. And you get that reroll for that price, but that price adds up and eventually becomes fallout. And that's when bad things happen to the character.
Okay.
So it's a give and take game. The more you're willing to put into the game, the more successful your character can be, the more scenes you're willing to take for your character, the more chances you have on recovering from stress and recovering from fallout. So it creates spotlight by creating someone who is choosing to make their hero important in play by utilizing those tools. In addition to just those basic tools, there are options for swapping out capabilities. So if you don't want to have a might score beyond an average human, because you don't really want to write down that you're just an average human in might. If you want to replace that with something else, like say your character is a better martial artist or brawler, and that's how their strength is important to their character, you can replace that might score with something else. But that is an optional rule. It's not required because I wanted to keep some of it fairly traditional. Okay. But it is. Villains can use monologues, and they can. What they do in that monologue is they delay stress. They push that stress back and away from them for as long as possible, which means that's why they can be heroes early on in a game. But later on, it gets harder and harder for them to get ahead of the heroes. And eventually, that stress is going to build up and just smack them down. But they can monologue at length. They can also do other things to relieve that stress, such as kill their own minions, which is something I have seen happen in games other people have run more often than games I run. Because a lot of my minions are a little more important to the villain than just discardable. But It is very much a game that sits on that indie line where it's got some unique elements, but I don't want to call them unique. They're more like oddball. Because saying it's unique tries to put it in a whole nother category, and I don't want to put it there. It's just its own thing. And in being its own thing, it does things a certain way. In the core book, there will be some example villains and some example heroes, and there is a timeline for the generic setting, but it's a general superhero setting. So four color, and here is the timeline of things that have happened. You know, there was a war with aliens. There was once an empire of sentient dinosaurs, and they created slaves, and some of that stuff still crops up, you know, millions upon millions of years later to be villains or impact heroes in modern times. Or they give you an option if you want to run a superhero game set stores that are sapient and magic using, and you want to do something completely different with a superhero game.
So speaking of what you have going on as far as the game goes, who's doing the art?
My primary artist is Scott Harshbarger. And Scott Harshbarger has been a very great artist for doing what I want. But I also have art from some rather decent artists, such as Amanda Webb, who does a really good job, you know, putting what I want on paper in an animated style. I've got some art from Dan Houser, who also does a similar animated style, and some art from D.A. Miller, as well as a gentleman named Jay Sutton, who doesn't really, he doesn't want his name put out there a whole lot. So he's kind of this anonymous artist that, you know, just has done some art for me, and it's really good art. It all is does what I want it to do, and that is portray different ages of comic books rather than a single age where you have the absolute best art. Some of it portrays different time periods and different styles, because, you know, there are different styles in comic books all the time. For example, there's a very unique style going on with Marvel's Squirrel Girl, and that adds flavor to that setting around her, that it's very unique. And it's just that's what I'm aiming for, is to have a whole bunch of different flavors so that no one is stuck with, oh, this must be a super serious superhero game, or it must be a super silly superhero game because your character's monologue, and, you know, it could be any of those. And that's why I've chosen several different artists. But Scott is the primary artist who's provided most of the big ornate pictures that will fill the book.
Yes,
Go ahead, sir.
I was going to say, Scott did some work for us at the Fan and Goat Games back in the day, particularly for Stark City. So I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah. He has been more than kind. No, that's where most of the money for the Kickstarter is going, is to artists and layout and editing. I mean, I'm not asking for much. I'm just asking for enough to get the art I need and the editing I need to make the game beautiful and well edited, because that is something that I've seen fail in a lot of games. And so, you know, my take in it is actually extremely small, and not because I'm not proud of my work, but because of the opposite. I'm very proud of the hard work I've put into this. And I don't need monetary compensation so much as just getting the game out there and having people play it. So that's what I'm trying to do with the second edition, is just get it out there and enjoy it and try something a little different than traditional, but not so weird that traditional players can't understand it or aren't willing to reach out and give it a try.
So where did the idea... Where did the idea for a wooden woman bench pressing a dump truck come from?
She's actually stone. Okay. Her name is La Roca, which is Spanish for the rock or a rock. She's actually fairly slender and just very tall to start out with. Very athletic build. But as she gets stronger, she gets rockier and rockier looking, and puts on more and more mass. So basically, the more she suffers stress, the stronger she gets to compensate. But that doesn't always help if your situational stress is emotional stress. If something causing you pain or problems is mental. So, you know, she suddenly, you know, bursts out of the seams and is this big rocky heroine, and that's not necessarily going to resolve her being mocked, who she can't reach and can't punch. So that's where she comes from, is that she's the brick of the main super team, which are the Lone Star Sentinels, because the setting is focused on a city in Texas. Although I have the entire world and the timeline for that entire world written out in the game, you'll probably only see highlights from Sentinel City unless we fund at higher level. And if we fund at higher levels, well, that's good, because there'll be a source book in it for those who help me fund it that covers more of the world and more of the heroes that exist in that world. Although I have kind of murdered a lot of the heroes in my setting in the past, and even the Lone Star Sentinels are, you know, La Roca's still alive, but she's in a coma. But most of the other Lone Star Sentinels are believed to be dead. And that's also that player characters are the important movers and shakers of the world. Because, you know, I can give you hundreds and hundreds of heroes, that I've created or played or wanted to play, but or just imagined and drawn at some point, because sometimes the pencil just does what it wants. But instead, I want it to be about what you want your game to be about, what characters you want to be important. And if you want to pick up the Lone Star Sentinels and play them, certainly that's fine. I will include them in the book. But if you want to have everybody make original characters at the table and run them and make them the important characters in the game, I have left room for you to do that.
How long does character creation take? Is it a lengthy process? Is it collaborative with the GM?
It depends on which method you choose. There is a collaborative process with the GM, which is a modeling or the primary system I prefer to use. You talk through it with your GM, and that takes however long it takes for the player to come up with an idea. And you talk through it with the player, the GM, and maybe other players help throw in good ideas. And that's the longest one. There is a short version that where you create a thumbnail that gives you the character's backstory and just a tiny little like sentence or two sentence long snippet of their backstory. And then you can use the first method to finish. Or you can take a step to the third method, which is just completely random rolling up your character, which takes very little time at all. It's just a, you know, a handful of dice rolls and you've got a character sheet ready to go. And then there's a final method where you have this many ranks, because the game has a rank and a scale system, and it gives you so many ranks that you can buy up your specific attribute or power you want to a certain rank and scale. So, because you just get to the end of one list of the scale and you jump to the next scale. And you just spend, like, say, if you want to go from human, you know, spectacular human strength to average superhuman strength, you just spend 5 ranks. And that, or actually, it's 4, because you get average human for free. So you spend 4 ranks and you jump that human to superhuman scale. But it's they're all really simple when you get down to it. The most complicated is the basic system, which is discussion. But the truth about Hearts and Souls is that it is a game where high trust is important, where you trust your GM, you trust your players to make characters that are going along with what you've pitched to them as the kind of game you want to run. As a GM of dozens upon dozens of superhero games, I know that getting characters on the same page is sometimes problematic. I'm actually having that problem with a game that I'm running that's not Hearts and Souls, and not all the players are on the same page, so I have to talk to them about getting to the same page. But I've gotten 2 of 3 characters, so I'm doing good with that game. But that's a big important, because I feel that a discussion between the game master and the players, what we call the editor, is important to make the best game possible. You've got to trust that person across the table, and they've got to trust you to make any gaming work. Rules can't fix that, in my opinion, because I've got a very rules heavier game than Hearts and Souls, and even the rules are not fixing that situation, where I've got a player who's not sure what they want to play, and part of that comes from they're not sure if they can trust me enough to make it fun at the particular level they chose. And that's, they're a new player to my type of gaming, so they don't know how much to trust me. It happens.
Right on. So you got what, 30 days left?
Yeah, I've got 14
23 days.
For 23 days? Is it 23? I have not kept count. In fact, I have not looked at the Kickstarter besides to post an update about doing a chat and another update to change the time of the chat. Because I really don't want to look. I don't want to worry about the money. So, and I'm sure there are people who check their Kickstarter every day, but I'm like, I'm not looking unless I have to make an update or I have to share a podcast or something similar. Right. So it's like, I'm just going to let it do what it does and go where it goes. because otherwise it's going to stress me out. And I don't want to be stressed out.
So everybody should go and immediately back their Hearts and Souls second edition tabletop role-playing game Kickstarter. I can't believe I just said that without tripping up my own tongue.
Yes, yes. And it is a long thing. But I want to be clear what it is for everybody who goes to Kickstarter. It's very important to me if y'all would back it. You know, I mean, I'm a little guy. I literally work alone for the most part besides hiring artists and editors. So it's not like this is a game written by five or six people. It's just me who wrote it. And that's, you know, literally it. So it's one of those situations where I want, I want your help. I'm asking for your help. Help me make it as big and beautiful as possible. And that is the important thing, is reaching out to y'all and going, hey, you know, give me a little help here.
Right on.
Let's make that book a beautiful one.
And hey, I just wanted to mention, Norbert Franz is one of your editors, and he's been doing some editing work for me. He is a great guy. So that was a good choice.
He really is. He's been a friend of mine for a long, long time, since before I think he did any editing. He has run Hearts and Souls First Edition, and he wants to do a chat with me as well, which is a good thing, in my opinion. He said he can't do an unbiased chat with me. And I'm like, that's fine. Just let everybody know that it's not unbiased because we've been friends for a long time. So it's going to be a fun thing to do as well.
All right, cool. Well, good to have you on, Tim. Everyone check out Hearts and Souls Second Edition on Kickstarter. And just to review what we've reviewed on this top of the hour, Chris McLaughlin gave us a fun, interesting review of Bad Times at the Al Royale.
Well, thank you, sir.
I think that's in theaters now, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But go get it before they throw it out in favor of a remake or a reboot or a sequel or a reimagined sequel reboot.
Indeed.
Before that Knight Rider movie comes out, you want to go see that.
Oh, boy.
And, Jacob, you reviewed Starfinder Armory and Starfinder Against the Aeon Throne Adventure Path.
Yep.
And we found the Adventure Path to be fun and Armory to be satisfactory gun porn.
Indeed.
Okay. And Walt had one big thumb up for The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix.
Also a difficult thing to get out in one say without twisting your tongue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got to wrap up and go pick up the kid from kindergarten, but I'd like to thank all of our viewers, listeners. Well, I guess viewers, we're on YouTube these days, so it's the Banff Media Empire. We're everywhere now. And if you want to listen to us on anchor.fm, we're there too, because, why not? Thanks, everybody, for checking us out, and we will catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.
Poof.